Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to finish up the book of Genesis, chapter 50, the last chapter. We'll do all 26 verses. This chapter discusses Jacob and Joseph's deaths. Our context is this. Chapter 49, Jacob has blessed all of his sons, the patriarchs, and we get to see the history of the patriarchs because it was not only a blessing that Jacob gave, he gave prophecies about what was to happen to the descendants of his children. So we start now in Genesis 50, verses 1 and 2 and 3. Oh, and I forgot to mention it. Then to chapter 50, Jacob died. And so this is where we are at verse 1. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Israel is Jacob. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Now when it says Joseph fell on his father's face, that means he laid his face on Jacob's face, gave him a farewell kiss. Remember, Jacob's lying in bed now. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown adds the touching detail that Joseph then closed Jacob's eyes. Now how he knows that, I don't know. I don't think he was there, but I guess we can assume that. The last verse in Genesis 49 shows us when Jacob died. When Jacob had finished giving charges to his sons, he drew his feet into the bed, took his last breath, and was gathered to his people. Now Joseph started crying. I mean, you know, Jacob was an old man, 187 years old. It's time for him to go, but you know, it's all parting is tough. It just is. And Joseph cried. Now he's an emotional and sensitive man, Joseph is. I'm going to give you 6 scriptures where Joseph cried. It's kind of interesting. First occasion when the brothers first visited Joseph in Egypt, Genesis 42:24. He, Joseph, turned away from them, from his brothers, and wept. Second occasion, the brothers had come to Egypt the second time, bringing Benjamin with them that time, this time, and they went to Joseph's house for a feast, Genesis 43:30. Joseph hurried out, for he was deeply stirred over his brother, that's Benjamin, and he sought a place to weep. So he started boo-hooing and crying. And if you read the story, well, let's go down to Genesis 45:2. The occasion here is Joseph has revealed his identity to his brothers. He, Joseph, wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. So Joseph was a weeper. Genesis 45:14-15. Then he, the occasion here is when Joseph, the same occasion where Joseph has revealed his identity to his brothers. Then he, Joseph, fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. Verse 15, Genesis 45, he, Joseph, kissed all his brothers and wept on them. Now, the next occasion when Joseph meets his father for the first time in Egypt as Jacob has come from Canaan, Genesis 46:29, Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father, Israel, Jacob. As soon as he appeared before him, he, Joseph, fell on his, Jacob's neck and wept on his neck a long time. And in this chapter, when we get down to verse 17, we read this. The occasion is this. The brothers had told Joseph that Jacob had commanded Joseph to forgive his brothers because it shows that the brothers were still very suspicious of Joseph. They were scared that Joseph might put him in the hooskow or something because of what they had done to Joseph. And so the brothers are relaying an alleged message, might be true, might not be true, from their father Jacob. This is what Jacob was purported to have said. Say this to Joseph, please forgive your brother's transgressions and their sin, the suffering they caused you. Therefore, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. When Joseph heard that, Joseph wept when their message came to him. Probably, in my opinion, he cried because he thought it was terrible. His brothers were still so suspicious of him. But at any rate, isn't that something? 6 times that Joseph cried. I've got 2 friends who, men, male friends, who will cry at the drop of a hat. And, you know, people say that only women do that. No, that's not true. Like I said, these 2 friends of mine are men. And my wife is a woman, and she cries very little. In fact, when she does, it's a frightening experience for me because she almost never does. So people are different about that. It doesn't mean that people who don't cry aren't as sensitive as people who do cry. This is just an observation. Joseph did cry. He cried a lot. Now, Joseph in verse 2 had physicians embalm his fathers. NIV Study Bible says that maybe Joseph wanted to avoid the use of professional embalmers because professional embalmers would have to go through pagan ceremonies, and Joseph didn't want to go through that. I don't know if you can make that much distinction between one word. Maybe so. Now, 40 days were required for embalming. That's because It took a long time for all the spices that were involved in the embalming process to soak into the body. Now, embalming was customary amongst the Egyptians, as I'm sure you know. That's why we have all these Tutankhamun-type mummies floating around on the internet with pictures. Also in the Cairo Museum in Egypt, lots of mummies survived because of that embalming process. That was customary, but it was also necessary in order to get Jacob's body back to Canaan, because he wouldn't have made it. He would have just been bones if they had just carried his body. His body would have degenerated. So Joseph had his body embalmed, so when he arrived at Hebron, he would be embalmed as a corpse, not as a bag of bones. Now, I am going to regale you with a description of the embalming process, because this is really interesting. This is from John Gill. Quote, "The manner of embalming, as Herodotus relates, was this. First, with a crooked iron instrument, they extracted the brain through the nostrils, which they got out partly by this means and partly by the infusion of medicines. Then, with a sharp Ethiopian stone, they cut about the flank and from thence took out all the bowels, which, when they had cleansed, they washed with palm wine, and after that, or wine of dates, and after that again with odors, bruised. Then they filled, I'm not sure what bruised means here. Then they filled the bowels, or a hollow place out of which they were taken, with pure myrrh, beaten, and with cassia and other odors, frankincense excepted, and sewed them up." So they put a bunch of spices inside the body. "After which they seasoned the corpse with nitre, hiding or covering it therewith 70 days, and more than that they may not season it. The 70 days being ended, they washed the corpse and wrapped the whole body in bands of fine linen. Besmearing it with gum, which gum the Egyptians used generally instead of glue. And Diodorus Siculus, who gives much the same account, says that every part was retained so perfectly that the very hairs of the eyebrows and the whole form of the body were invariable, and the features might be known. And the same writer tells us that the expense of embalming was different. The highest priced was a talent of silver, about 187 pounds and 10 shillings of our money, which of course is obsolete now. The middlemost 20 pounds, and the last and lowest were very small. The embalmers he calls Tarikutai, and says they were in great esteem, and reckoned mostly of much honor, and were very familiar with the priest, and might go into holy places when they pleased as the priests themselves." So in other words, embalmers did some very gross work, and they were very honored and important back in Egyptian society. And Joseph, of course, would have access to embalmers because he was a big shot. Now, the 70 days of mourning probably overlap the 40 days of embalming, as the NIV Study Bible says. I think probably so. So that means after the embalmed body was embalmed, it would lay in state, I guess you might say, for 30 days before they actually put it in the ground. We go now to Genesis 50, verses 4 through 6. "When the days of mourning for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, 'If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am about to die. In my grave which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, then I will return.' Pharaoh said, 'Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear.'" Now who is this household of Pharaoh that Joseph was speaking to? Well, that would be his servants probably, his governmental servants who took care of the Pharaoh personally. Why didn't Joseph approach Pharaoh directly? Here's some options. First of all, as Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggest, that as a mourner, Joseph could not appear in the royal presence. That makes sense. It could be. Another option is his office was not as high as before. He used to be number two in the land, but now the famine's over. Joseph is no longer in control of the grain. Maybe he's not such a big shot anymore. I don't think that's reasonable. I think the Pharaoh loves Joseph for what he did. I don't think that would stop him from seeing Pharaoh. It could be that he went to the servants of Pharaoh rather than Pharaoh himself, option number three, to make those men his friends, to keep them from objecting about his journey, objecting about sending Jacob to Canaan, or to keep them from plotting against him when he's gone. Actually, Joseph is actually going with the brothers to bury Jacob, and that might cause political problems at home. So he's saying, hey, guys, talk to Pharaoh and understand I'm coming back. He did say, I will return, like MacArthur. That's to keep himself out of political trouble. Well, that makes sense. Fourth option as to why he went to the household of Pharaoh rather than Pharaoh himself is because Joseph is in Goshen, which is the northeast of Egypt. good long way from the Pharaoh's court. It just might not have been convenient for him to go back to the Pharaoh, so he sent some of Pharaoh's messengers back, his servants back, to tell Pharaoh, or to ask Pharaoh. Now, when did Jacob make Joseph swear to take Jacob back to Canaan? This is what Joseph is telling the servants to tell Pharaoh, and this was, of course, true, because in Genesis 47, verses 29 through 31, we read this. When the time for Israel to die, that's Jacob, Israel is Jacob, to die, when the time for him to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh," that's how they did oaths back then, "and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And he said, "I will do as you have said." He said, "Swear to me." So he swore to him. And that's not because he didn't trust Joseph. He just wanted to, he was anxious to make it formal. Then Israel bowed and worshiped at the head of the bed. All right, so Joseph is carrying out his dying father's wish. Now, an oath to a dying man had a special import. And that oath that Joseph swore to Jacob, that oath may have been what persuaded Pharaoh to let Joseph go, because an oath was considered sacred and inviolate. Now, there were some reasons that Pharaoh might not have wanted Joseph to go. He might have appreciated his government service and didn't want him gone a long time. He also might have thought practically, well, heck, why do you need to give Jacob a funeral in Canaan? You can give him a big funeral right here in Egypt. Of course, he wouldn't understand all about the promises. And Pharaoh says, look, I got a lot of money. You got some money. We can put it together and have a big shindig for a funeral. Why do you want to go to Canaan? Well, of course, again, he didn't understand the promise to Abraham of land, the promised land. Now, Joseph, in recounting his father Jacob's dying admonition to him, quotes Jacob as saying, "Behold, I'm about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me." Well, that's talking about the cave at Hebron, in the field of Machpelah, before the oak of Mamre. That Hebrew word there for dug could also mean bought, according to the NIV Study Bible, but dug is the better translation here, because it was Abraham who bought the burying place at Hebron. It was not Jacob. So is the grave which I dug for myself. So apparently he's already dug the grave in preparation. John Gill speculates he dug that grave when he buried Leah. Leah's death is not recorded in the scripture and her burial, but that's a speculation. Now Joseph, as I said in verse 5, said, "I shall return," just like MacArthur said when he left the Philippines and went to Australia in World War II, "I will return." That's very important for Jacob to say that. I mean, after all, him leaving with all of his family, people might think, aha, he's absconding from Egypt with all his wealth. He's going to make chumps out of us. No, Joseph is very faithful to his governmental duties. He says, "I'm coming back." Now, Joseph mentions that Jacob is asking Joseph to bury him in his grave that he had dug. The Egyptians were notoriously concerned about their graves. As you know, the pyramids were graves. So Pharaoh must have had empathy for Jacob's request. Oh, grave, the afterlife, oh yeah, go back. And that's another reason why I'm sure Pharaoh sent Joseph off with his blessing with no trouble. And in verse 6, where our text says, Pharaoh said, "Go up and bury your father." Remember, Egypt is at a lower elevation than Hebron in the Promised Land. So we go now to Genesis 50, verses 7 through 9. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the household of Joseph, and his brothers, and his father's household. They left only their little ones, and their flocks, and their herds in the land of Goshen. There also went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. Now, in verse 7, Joseph is said to have gone up with all the servants of Pharaoh. As John Gill says, that means a great number of them, but not all literally. Obviously, some of Pharaoh's servants had to stay behind to serve Pharaoh. And this is another example of where all doesn't mean all, as these misguided haul-it-and-call-it faith message charismatics used to tell me when I was in the charismatic movement, all always means all. When he healed all those who were in Israel, all always means all. Well, no, it doesn't. Sometimes it means many. Look it up in a lexicon. I've done that many times. And that little word comes up in a lot of theological controversies, surprisingly enough, as I keep having to go back to it and having to decide, do we translate this as all or many? Well, here's an example. No, it just means many. All the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, that means the elders of Pharaoh's household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. Apparently there's a distinction between Pharaoh's personal servants and also the government officials. In other words, this was a heap big delegation coming from Egypt, going up to Canaan to bury Joseph's father. That's how much honor they gave Joseph. And also all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household. That means, well, that's obvious what that means. Jacob and the 12 sons, they went up, and also their kids, their wives, and their servants, but they left the kids. They left only their little ones and their flocks and their herds. Why did they leave their flocks and their herds? Well, it's difficult to carry children and flocks across the desert. And also, leaving those flocks and herds and children, it makes all the Egyptians know that the Israelites, the Hebrews, are not about to flee Egypt. They're coming back because they wouldn't leave their children there. Well, why would the Egyptians care about that? Well, this is my speculation. The Egyptians might not like to see all these Hebrews leave Egypt because that's a lot of taxes that would be gone. The Hebrews up there making money, if you recall, or being prosperous. And when you're prosperous, you got to pay taxes to the government, and all of a sudden they're gone. That means Egypt loses some prosperity. So the Egyptians were probably worried about the Hebrews leaving, and the Hebrews said, well, let me put your worry at rest because we've got our children and our wealth here. We're obviously coming back. Verse 9, there also went up with him, with Joseph, both chariots and horsemen. Now, chariots went there for honor because chariots are expensive vehicles for honor and also for safety because they can drive off brigands on the route, I suppose. Chariots were more than ordinary wagons. They were fancy honorary vehicles. And it was a very great company. Yes, sir, it was a very big company that went up to Canaan. Chapter 50, verses 10 through 11 of Genesis. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, that company of Egyptians and Hebrews, when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation. And he observed 7 days mourning for his father. That's Joseph observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. It actually wasn't for the Egyptians, it was for Jacob, but I guess it was understandable that they misunderstood that because there were so many Egyptians in the company. Therefore it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. All right, the threshing floor of Atad, where they came, where they had all the lamentation and 7 days mourning. Atad is the name of the guy who owned the threshing floor. Of course, its location is lost. Atad means thorn or bramble, so it could mean that Atad just means the name of the person, or it could mean the threshing floor of brambles or thorns instead of, it's not the name of a person, but it's describing the thorns or brambles that were at the threshing floor. Nobody knows. It doesn't really matter. They mourn there for 7 days, and of course the mourning of the east, you know, you got all these professional mournings and wailings and cryings and so forth, so this was a ceremonial type mourning. The 7 days was standard. It later became standard by the Jews. We see it codified in Numbers 19:19. Then the clean person shall sprinkle on the unclean on the third day, and on the seventh day, and on the seventh day he shall purify himself from uncleanness, and he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be clean by the evening. This is to purify somebody that's touched a corpse or had something to do with a dead body. Got 7 days, you're unclean. And so I guess the 7 days of mourning makes sense. If you extrapolate from the customary 7 days of warning, you end up with 7 days of being unclean. We also see in 1 Samuel 31:13, when Saul and his sons got killed at Jabesh at Bethshan against the Pharisees, Saul's people took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. So apparently that was the typical thing that you did. You didn't eat for 7 days, or you mourned for 7 days. Fasting goes along with mourning. Now the Canaanites who saw all this, they named the place Abel Mizraim. Abel means mourning, and Mizraim means Egypt. So the phrase means the mourning of the Egyptians. And of course the site, as I said, is unknown. As Easton's dictionary says, Easton's actually says it's to the west of the Jordan. I don't think so. It says beyond the Jordan. I guess it could be on the west, but usually you see that phrase beyond the Jordan. It means on the east of the Jordan. At any rate, we go now to Genesis 50, verses 12 through 14. Thus his sons did for him as he had charged them. That's Jacob's sons. Did as Jacob had charged them. He told them to carry his body back up to Canaan. Verse 13, Genesis 50, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had brought along with a field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. Now, Machpelah before Mamre is just to learn this. This is the grave of the patriarch. The city is Hebron. There's a field there called Machpelah. There's an oak tree there called Mamre. Just remember, the field of Machpelah, the oak tree of Mamre, all at Hebron. And that's where all the patriarchs were buried except Rachel, because she didn't make it down there because she died in childbirth near Bethlehem. Now, this was the precise field that Abraham had bought, where Abraham had buried. Well, let me just go through and say all who's buried there. Abraham and his wife Sarah, Isaac and his wife Rebekah, Jacob, but not his wife Rachel. She died in Bethlehem in childbirth with Benjamin. But his wife Leah was buried there, and now Jacob's going to be buried there. Ironically, Joseph is not buried there, and I don't know why. He ended up being buried in Shechem, but that's okay. Most of the patriarchs ended up being buried at Hebron. I am not going to read all the scriptures that show that the patriarchs are buried at Hebron. This is non-controversial. It'd be a little tedious to go through it. You just have to take my word for it. So in verse 14, after he had buried his father, and that, this is, of course, in Hebron, Joseph returned to Egypt. This is something I don't really understand. Why would they stop at a field, a threshing floor of Atad, and have all the mourning and then do the burial in Hebron? Why not have all the mourning right there in Hebron? I don't know, unless the threshing floor of Atad was near Hebron, maybe. But, of course, that would mean it would be to the west of the Jordan, as Easton says, rather than to the east of the Jordan, as usually you think that when you hear beyond the Jordan. So I don't know. It's a minor detail. Doesn't matter. In verse 14, very importantly, Joseph returns to Egypt and also the brothers, because that's where their wealth is, their children, and so forth. We go now to Genesis 50, verses 15 through 17. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.'" I guess the quotation marks don't show up in the audio, so I need to read that again. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, quote, this is what the brothers are saying to Joseph. "Your father," that's Jacob, "charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph.'" Now we have another quotation. This is the alleged quotation of Jacob to the brothers, who were supposed to relay this to Joseph. Quote, "Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong." Close quote. So now that's relaying the message of Jacob, and now the brothers are going back to their discussion with Joseph. And now the brothers say, "Please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father," God of Jacob. And close quote. Joseph hears this and he begins to cry. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Now, it's reasonable that the brothers might think that Joseph wanted to pay them back, because they had done him really dirty. Tried to kill him at first, lied to their father about what happened to him, and then sold him into slavery. When Jacob did something much less criminal than that, got Esau to hand over the birthright that Esau had from Isaac, handed it over to Jacob, Esau was mad enough to kill him. Genesis 27:41. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob." In other words, when my father's around so he can't stop it, I'm going to kill Jacob. Well, Joseph's brothers are thinking the same thing. Oh, now that Jacob's not around to stop it, Joseph might be wanting to kill us. Now, Joseph's not going to kill us if Jacob's alive. Obviously, he's not going to cause that much pain to his father, Jacob. But now that Jacob's dead, he might come after us in revenge. Adam Clark says the brothers might have thought that Joseph was hiding his murderous motives while Jacob was still alive. Or it could be, Adam Clark further speculates, maybe the brothers' conscience has started to bother them a little bit. Ooh, what we did was terrible. Oh, and you know, somebody with a guilty conscience thinks bad things are going to happen to them. Now, here's another question. Was this true, what the brothers were saying to Joseph? Was it true that Jacob had charged them, saying, "Tell Joseph, forgive your brothers. Did Jacob really do that? Well, John Gill says, no, the brothers are lying. He says that if the brothers had known, if Jacob had known about what the brothers did to Joseph, trying to kill him, he would have said so in his final blessing. Well, as I pointed out as we were going through the last chapters of Genesis, it's not recorded anywhere that the brothers apologized to Jacob for what they did to Joseph. We don't know that they did. My feeling is that they more or less had to have, because how would Jacob know? How could they explain that Joseph ended up being number two in Egypt? That's such an incredible thing. There had to be a reason for it. So I suspect they had already told Jacob about the coat of many colors and the animal blood that they smeared on it, the fraud they perpetrated on Jacob, and the selling into slavery. I think so. But Gill says that if Jacob had known, he would have said so. I don't necessarily think so, that Jacob would have brought that up in his final blessing, because he might not have wanted to bring up an unpleasant subject. On the other hand, he did bring up some unpleasant subjects about Shechem and Levi and Simeon killing the Shechemites, and Reuben sleeping with his concubine, so maybe he could have done that. Well, then he would have had to disinherit every last one of them. So, I don't know. Adam Clark disagrees with Gill and says, no, the brothers weren't making this up. Jacob really had said that. Now, I think Clark is right here. I think that Jacob knew about the attempted fratricide of Joseph. As I just said, how else is Jacob going to understand that Joseph ended up being number two in Egypt? The brothers must have told him. But then, and not only that, even if Jacob had not known about the attempted murder of Joseph, he would have known about, well, he probably would have known about the sale into slavery. How else would Joseph had gotten down to Egypt? Well, we don't know. So the commentators disagree. But in my opinion, just reading it, it sounds to me like the brothers weren't making this up. They were sincerely, that they were recording a sincere desire of their father, because their father would have known. Their father, Jacob, might have thought, Joseph is going to come after my son, other sons. So I'm telling you now, you need to tell him that it's my desire as the patriarch, Jacob, that Joseph not exact revenge on you guys. I think it was true. I think Jacob actually said that. I don't think it was made up. But anyway, I report, you decide. That could go either way. When Joseph heard what the brothers were saying to him, relaying that alleged message of Jacob that Joseph is supposed to forgive his brothers, Joseph immediately breaks down crying. Here's some options as to why. First, NIV Study Bible says this: Joseph is sad that his brothers falsely implicated their father in their story. That's one option. Well, that assumes that Jacob never said that they made that up. Well, I don't believe that, so I don't like that option. Option number two: Joseph may have regretted his failure to reassure his brothers earlier that he had forgiven them. I don't know. How much reassuring should he do? I mean, he had the banquet. He cried all over them, wept on their necks, gave them all this money and garments and all this stuff. I mean, what more could he have done to show that he had forgiven them? It was obvious from Joseph's attitude that he had forgiven his brother. So I think the NIV Study Bible suggestions there are off the mark. John Gill says that Joseph may have regretted that his brothers had such a low opinion of him. Now let's flesh this option number three presented by John Gill out a little bit. Joseph regretted his brothers had such a low opinion of him. What kind of low opinion? Well, they thought that Joseph would sink so low as to kill his brothers or to throw them in jail, especially after all he had done for them. He rescued them from famine. He set them up in Goshen, and they still don't trust me? I'd imagine that's pretty disappointing for Joseph. I think there's your option right there. There's your answer right there, option number three. We go now to Genesis chapter 50, verses 18 through 21. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for I am in God's place." For am I in God's place? Question. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now the fact that his brothers fell down, that's one more time where the brothers fulfilled Joseph's dreams many years before. About 22 years before, Genesis 37:7. For behold, this is Joseph recounting his dream to his brothers. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered round and bowed down to my sheaf. Here they are, bowing down before Joseph here in verse 18 in Genesis 50. We're your servants. There was another dream too. Genesis 37:9. Now he, Joseph, had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, lo, I have had still another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And of course, the 11 stars, there are his brothers, and here they are bowing down to him. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? And what some options as to what Joseph meant there. First, option number one, hey, it's God that should receive homage, not Joseph. Don't bow down to me, bow down to God. Or you could say, it's God who judges. I'm not going to be the one to judge you for your sin. God does it. Clark says it can be taken affirmatively and not as a question. And so it will be translated, I am in God's place. In other words, I can provide substance for your children. I can take care of you. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm in God's place. I don't know. I think it's better to take it as a question. Hey, am I in God's place? You don't need to bow down to me and you don't need to fear me. Now, verse 20 is oft quoted by Christians. As for you, brothers meant evil against me, Joseph, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. And, of course, that means all the Hebrews that were preserved alive, plus all the other surrounding nations, plus all the Egyptians that were preserved because of Joseph's clever handling of the grain situation. And, of course, the application of that is so good because there's so many times that evil is done against us, but we need to remember that when the evil comes, God's going to turn it around and work it for good, Romans 8:28. So, verse 21, Joseph comforted his brothers and spoke kindly to them. You don't need to worry, guys. I'm not going to kill you. Verse 22, Genesis 50, now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household. Remember, they had all come back from Canaan. Father's household, that's Jacob. Jacob's household is all the brothers, the 11 brothers, plus Joseph. They all were in Egypt. Joseph lived 110 years. All but 17 of his years were spent in Egypt. He was 17 when he was sold into slavery. So that means 110 minus 17 equals 93 years Joseph has spent in Egypt. He died. The Exodus is 144 years after Joseph's death. And then Exodus is when Moses took Joseph's bones and took them into Canaan. So his burial in the Promised Land was delayed a little bit. He died at 110. That's 80 years after his elevation to power. If you recall, Genesis 41 through 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he got out of jail and ended up being number two in Egypt. We go now to Genesis 50, verse 23. Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons. Also the sons of Machir, the sons of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. Now, the third generation of Ephraim's sons, this shows that Jacob's prediction that Ephraim would be the greatest and most numerous tribe, which it was. Well, he didn't say the most numerous. He said very numerous. This is in chapter 49 when he was blessing. Actually, it might have been chapter 47 when he was blessing Ephraim and Manasseh privately to Joseph. Now, this prediction that Ephraim would be very numerous in terms of population, we see this taking place now as Joseph starts to have sons through his sons. All right. We know that one of his sons was Manasseh, who, of course, is one of the 12 patriarchs. Manasseh had a son called Machir, and Machir had some sons, unnamed here. Joseph saw all of these. Now, the scripture says here that Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons. That's a little bit ambiguous because his third generation means his great-great-grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, or his grandchildren. Well, John Gill says it refers to his great-great-grandchildren. I have no idea how he comes up with that. I don't see how he can sort that. Maybe it was a typo. I don't know. But let's look at our two reasonable options. It either refers to Joseph's great-grandchildren or his grandchildren. Now, the Cambridge commentary suggests that the scripture here refers to the third generation of Ephraim's sons. That scripture is talking about great-grandchildren, if you start counting with Joseph's son. All right, to see how Cambridge and Ellicott calculate it such that the third generation of Joseph's great-grandsons, we do it this way. We start counting with Joseph's son. That's the first generation. So that's Ephraim, Joseph's son, is the first generation. Ephraim has sons. That's the grandchildren of Joseph. That's the second generation. And then Ephraim's sons have sons. That's the third generation. And that would be the great-grandchildren of Joseph. Now, I tend to think that's what it is, because if you look at Machir, who's the son of Manasseh, you end up with great grandsons. You got Manasseh, generation one. Then you got Machir, the son of Manasseh, generation two. And that's grandsons. And then Machir had sons. That would be great-grandsons, generation number three, and so the parallel seems to work. So I'm going to assume that we're talking about great-grandchildren here, both of Ephraim and Manasseh. If you start counting with Joseph, if Joseph is the first generation, and then Ephraim and Manasseh are the second generation, then the third generation is just the sons of Ephraim. That would be grandchildren for Ephraim, and great. There's no question it's great-grandsons of Machir. It's not ambiguous there. So let's just make this easy. Let's just say that Joseph, he lived long enough in Egypt after he buried Jacob. He lived there long enough to have great-grandchildren. And so the promise of Ephraim's and Manasseh having a lot of population is coming true. Now let's look at Machir here. We know that Machir, who was Manasseh's firstborn son, Joseph's firstborn son, we know that Machir is the son of Manasseh, so that makes Machir Joseph's grandson. Then the sons of Machir, which are mentioned here in verse 23, Genesis 50, the sons of Machir, that makes the sons of Machir Joseph's great-grandson. Now, Machir was the ancestor of the powerful Gileadites. The sons of Machir are not mentioned here in the verse, but we can go to other places in the scripture and see who they are. First of all, the firstborn son was Gilead, and he's sort of important. Joshua 17:1, now this was the lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. To Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, were allotted Gilead and Bashan. Now, Gilead is the area east of the Jordan River from the southeast tip of the Sea of Galilee to the east of the Jordan, down the Arabah Valley, down the Jordan Valley, all the way down to just around the northern tip of the Dead Sea is Gilead. It's mentioned all the time in the New Testament. Well, that was named after Machir's firstborn son, Gilead, who, of course, was in Egypt while Joseph was still alive. And then there were some sons after Gilead that were born to Machir, Peresh and Sheresh. We see that in 1 Chronicles 7:16. Machir's wife, Maacah, gave birth to a son, and she named him Peresh. His brother was named Sheresh. And as John Gill points out, Peresh and Sheresh were probably born before Joseph died. That would explain the plural reference here in our verse, Genesis 50:23, the sons of Machir. Machir had only one other son by his first wife. That was Gilead that we just talked about. He must have got married again, and he had to have some more sons, whoever they were. And they're mentioned in 1 Chronicles 7:16 as Peresh and Sheresh. So that is all more than you would probably ever want to know. But again, the main point is that Israel is prosperous. The promise to Abraham was land, offspring, and blessing. And there's lots of offspring coming here from Joseph. God is working his purposes out very slowly through the generation. Now, when it says the children were born on Joseph's knees, that doesn't mean the baby was born on Joseph's knees. That's a Hebraism. It's some way of saying they were adopted. The NIV says it probably means adopted, that Joseph adopted Machir's sons. Cambridge Commentary affirms that. John Gill says that, no, it doesn't mean adopted. It just means that Joseph often took up his grandsons on his lap, or his great-grandsons, took them up on his lap and dandled them on his knees as grandfathers or great-grandfathers, being fond of their grandchildren, are apt to do. Third option is when it says they were educated on his that they were born on his knees, it means they were educated by Joseph. They were born and then placed on Joseph's knees as he then educated them. I don't think that's what it is. I think the majority view is that it means that Joseph actually adopted Machir's sons to put him into Joseph's tribe. We go now to verses 24 through 26 of Genesis 50, and we will finish the book of Genesis. Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. That would be at the Exodus, a couple hundred, 144 years later maybe. So let's say roughly 150 to 200 years later. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. The NIV Study Bible has a strange comment here in verse 24 where it says, Joseph said to his brothers, he's referring to more people than his blood brothers. I don't think so. John Gill says it's Joseph's 11 brothers, and I think that's who it is. And he said, I want you to take me up. I want to be buried in the promised land. Joseph had not forgotten God's promises. Hebrews 11:22 says this in the New Testament. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. And there, of course, Joseph didn't call it the exodus because the exodus hadn't occurred yet when he was talking. But in the book of Hebrews, it's clear that Joseph was referring to what later would become the exodus, and he wanted his bones out. Again, why? He wants to die in the promised land. He believed God's promises to Abraham about the land, land, offspring, and blessing. And so he tells his brothers, you got to take my bones up from here when you go back. Well, actually, I guess he was assuming his brothers would go back eventually because of that promise, that land promise. He says, whenever you do, guys, take my bones too. Now, remember, Joseph's father, Jacob, had made a similar request about Jacob's bones, Genesis 47, 29 through 31. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place, the burial place of my fathers. Please swear, Joseph. And Joseph swore. So Jacob asked Joseph to get Jacob's bones back to Canaan. That was carried out by the brothers at the funeral of Jacob, and they buried him in Hebron. And Joseph's bones were carried back to Israel because of Moses at the Exodus. We read this in Exodus 13:19. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he, Joseph, had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones from here with you. We read also in Joshua 24, verse 32. Now they buried the bones of Joseph, which the sons of Israel brought up from Egypt at Shechem, not Hebron. Joseph was buried at Shechem. I've speculated, I don't know why they buried Joseph at Shechem instead of at Hebron in the field of Machpelah near the Oak of Mamre. I don't know. Abraham and Sarah were buried there. Isaac and Rebekah were buried there. Jacob and Leah. Why not Joseph? I don't know. It's not recorded. John Gill points out that the national feeling of the Egyptians would have opposed removing Joseph's bones to Canaan. Well, I don't think that has anything to do with the Exodus. The national feeling of the Egyptians was, get these people out of here. We don't want any more plagues falling on our land. These people are a jinx. Their God is plaguing us. So get out of here. So I don't think Moses had any problem getting Joseph's bones out of Egypt at the Exodus. Now, Joseph died at 110. Ancient Egyptian records say that 110 was considered an ideal lifespan. So when Joseph died at 110, the Egyptians would have thought, hey, Joseph was divinely blessed. And he had a good reputation. He saved the land from famine and destruction, of course. Now, we've been talking about Joseph's bones being carried back to Canaan at the Exodus. Well, it was more than his bones. It was his whole body. We see in verse 26 that Joseph was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. It's not just his bones, it was his whole body, his embalmed body. And of course, embalmed bodies can last forever, as you know, if you've looked at the mummies that are all over museums everywhere in the world. So when we read the term bones, carry my bones, bones is a metonymy, part standing for the whole. The bones were the part of the body that stood for the whole body that went back up to Egypt. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that Joseph's mummified corpse would have been preserved whole until the Exodus. Of course it was. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished the book of Genesis. We are now ready to start the book of Exodus, which I will do in our next audio. We'll take up the whole chapter 1, Exodus 1, verses 1 through 22. I'm going to call that chapter A New Pharaoh Enslaves Israel. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.